So today we'll probably finish off the section on the khandhas, and there's a couple suttas that Ajahn Karunavimha made note of, just wrote the numbers down, and left them for me. Oh, okay, well, this actually, you said sort of optional/additional, but I think that's important. This is Sanyutta 22, Khanda Sanyutta, and it's Sutta number 53. That's Savati. Bhikkhus, one who is engaged is unliberated. One who is disengaged is liberated. Consciousness, bhikkhus, while standing, might stand engaged with form, based upon form, established upon form. With the sprinkling of delight, it might come to growth, increase, and expansion. Or consciousness, while standing, might stand engaged with feeling, engaged with perception, engaged with volitional formations. Based upon volitional formations, established upon volitional formations, with a sprinkling of delight, it might come to growth, increase, and expansion. Because though someone might say, apart from form, apart from feeling, apart from perception, apart from volitional formations, I will make known the coming and going of consciousness, its passing away and rebirth, its growth, increase, and expansion. That is impossible. Because if a bhikkhu has abandoned lust for the form element, with the abandoning of lust, the basis is cut off. There is no support for the establishing of consciousness. If he has abandoned lust for the feeling element, for the perception element, for the volitional formations element, for the consciousness element, with the abandoning of lust, the basis is cut off. There is no support for the establishing of consciousness. When that consciousness is unestablished, not coming to growth, non-generative, it is liberated. By being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more for this state of being. So it's just a little sutta, sort of significant. Just a little toss off at the end. Yeah, kind of a quick summary. There's one that's very similar, and I'll read that as well, and then go on to a bit of an explanation discussion. Okay. And it's Sutta number 54. It's the next one. At Savati. Because there are these five kinds of seeds. What five? Root seeds, stem seeds, joint seeds, cutting seeds, and germ seeds as the fifth. And they're sort of not really seeds, but ways of regeneration. If these five kinds of seeds are unbroken, unspoiled, undamaged by wind and sun, fertile, securely planted, but there is no earth or water, would these five kinds of seeds come to growth, increase, and expansion? No, venerable sir. If these five kinds of seeds are broken, spoiled, damaged by wind and sun, unfertile, not securely planted, but there is earth and water, would these five kinds of seeds come to growth, increase, and expansion? No, venerable sir. If these five kinds of seeds are unbroken, unspoiled, undamaged by wind and sun, fertile, securely planted, and there is earth and water, would these five kinds of seeds come to growth, increase, and expansion? Yes, venerable sir. Because the four stations of consciousness should be seen as like the earth element. Delight and lust should be seen as like the water element. Consciousness, together with its nutriment, should be seen as like the five kinds of seeds. Consciousness bhikkhus, while standing, might stand engaged with form, based upon form, established upon form, with a sprinkling of delight, it might come to growth, increase, and expansion. Or consciousness, while standing, might stand engaged with feeling, engaged with perception, engaged with volitional formations. Based upon volitional formations, established upon volitional formations, with a sprinkling of delight, it might come to growth, increase, and expansion. Because, though someone might say, apart from form, apart from feeling, apart from perception, apart from volitional formations, I will make known the coming and going of consciousness, its passing away and rebirth, its growth, increase, and expansion, that is impossible. Because if a bhikkhu has abandoned lust for the form element, with the abandoning of lust, the basis is cut off. There is no support for the establishing of consciousness. If he has abandoned lust for the feeling element, for the perception element, for the volitional formations element, for the consciousness element, with the abandoning of lust, the basis is cut off. There is no support for the establishing of consciousness. When that consciousness is unestablished, not coming to growth, non-generative, it is liberated. By being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands. Destroyed is birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. So those are two, I think, very important suttas that give a sense of the nature of nibbana and the process, and the kind of interdependence, of course, of the or that sense of the say these five khandhas being conjoined and not disjoined. They are functioning together, and they are both bringing into being consciousness and consciousness relying on these, so that it's all enmeshed together. And but then the aspects of and this is also where there's a similar sutta, and I didn't look it up. Can't remember. There's a sutta somewhere where the Buddha gives the image of also sort of seed and water and and it's but it's like based on the ignorance, craving, and kamma as the nutriment for the whole process of the regeneration of.
Is common soil, seeds, consciousness, and water the craving?
Okay. Kamma is the field. So that so that's another kind of something that's supportive of that, and then this sense of the consciousness being unestablished. So that unestablished doesn't mean sort of unmoored and floating somewhere, but it's more like because it's unestablished, then it's not engaging in that process of continual rebirth. I mean, moment to moment engagement with the process of becoming, and that is a and there's a whole chapter in this wonderful book. on unsupported and unsupportive consciousness, and that's a and also maybe the this sense of what is called consciousness is unestablished, then it's like a tadapatitan. So it's like not standing on anything, which is and I'll. Also, it ties in with another kind of concept of the say vijnana anidasana, which is say consciousness without feature. There's Ajahn Amaro translated as consciousness without feature. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates that as a consciousness that makes no showing. Morris Walsh translates it as consciousness that is signless. Bhikkhunyana Ananda translated as a consciousness which is non-manifestative. So this vijnana anidasana, and that's a bit more well known as an idiom, and it comes up a couple places in the suttas. Majjhima 49, questions from the Brahma Bhaka. And then in Diga 11, in the Kevada Sutta, and what the Sutta, what the Brahma didn't know. But anyway, there's a Sutta, Majjhima 22, and 36, which is like the paragraph 36. Bhikkhus, when the gods with Indra, with Brahma, with Pajahapati seek a bhikkhu who is thus liberated in mind, they do not find anything of which they could say, the consciousness of one thus gone is supported by this. Why is that? One thus gone is untraceable here and now. And there's also another one which is well known from the Nidana Samyutta, Samyutta 12, Sutta number 64. There are these four nutriments for the establishing of beings who have taken birth, or for the support of those in search of a place to be born. Which four? Physical food, gross or refined, contact as the second, consciousness the third, and intention is the fourth. These are the four nutriments for the establishing of beings who have taken birth, or for the support of those in search of a place to be born. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and grows. Where consciousness lands and grows, mentality, materiality, namarupa, alights. Where mentality, materiality alights, there is the growth of volitional formations. Where there is the growth of volitional formations, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is birth, aging, and death. Together, I tell you, with sorrow, affliction, and despair. Just as when there is dye, lac, yellow orpiment, indigo, or crimson, a dyer or painter would paint the picture of a woman or a man, complete in all its parts, on a well-polished panel or wall, or on a piece of cloth. In the same way, where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutriment of physical food, consciousness lands there and grows. Where consciousness lands and grows, mentality, materiality alights. Where mentality, materiality alights, there is the growth of volitional formations. Where there is the growth of volitional formations, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is birth, aging, and death. Together, I tell you, with sorrow, affliction, and despair. And that's similar with the other three kinds of nutriments. That is contact, consciousness, and intention. Where there is no passion for the nutriment of physical food, where there is no delight, no craving, then consciousness does not land there or grow. Materiality does not alight. There is no growth of volitional formations. There is no production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is no production of renewed becoming in the future, there is no birth, aging, and death. That, I tell you, is quite free from sorrow, affliction, or despair. Just as if there were a roofed house or a roofed hall, having windows on the north, the south, or the east. When the sun rises and a shaft of light has entered by way of the window, where does it land?
On the western wall, Venerable Sir.
And if there is no western wall?
On the ground, Venerable Sir.
And if there is no ground?
On the water, Venerable Sir.
And if there is no water?
And that's in the kind of the Buddhist cosmology, that water is kind of underneath the ground as the kind of the division of elements, or Indian.
And if there is no water, it does not land, Venerable Sir. In the same way, when there is no passion for physical nutriment, contact, consciousness, or intention, consciousness does not land or grow. That, I tell you, is quite free from sorrow, affliction, or despair. And then there's a short one from the Sutta Nipata, which is also has similar. One who is independent, and these are in verses, one who is independent does not tremble. One who is dependent clutches, grasps existence one way or another, and thus is unable to escape samsara. Consider this dark consequence. There is danger in dependence. Therefore, relying on nothing, the mindful bhikkhu travels on free from clinging. And there's one more similar with this theme of the consciousness unestablished. This is also from the Nidana Samyutta, so Samyutta 12, Sutta number 38. What is intended, cheteti, what is acted upon, pakkapeti, and what lies latent, anuseti. This is a support for the establishment of consciousness. There being a support, there is a landing of consciousness. When that consciousness lands and grows, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. When there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is future birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this entire mass of dukkha. If nothing is intended, if nothing is acted upon, but something lies latent, this is a support for the establishment of consciousness. There being a support, there is a landing of consciousness. When that consciousness lands and grows, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. When there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is future birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this entire mass of suffering, of dukkha. But when nothing is intended, acted upon, or lies latent, there is no support for the establishment of consciousness. There being no support, there is no landing of consciousness. When that consciousness does not land and grow, there is no production of renewed becoming in the future. When there is no production of renewed becoming in the future, there is no future birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of dukkha. So that gives a kind of illustrating that unestablished consciousness. And then in the
In this book of Skilling Questions of Ajahn Jass, he gives a footnote to that sutta concerning the sort of if there's a, just as if there are a roofed house and whatnot, when the sun rises and a ray is entered by way of the window, where does it land? Sort of on the western wall, if there's no western wall, so through. And he uses the explanation for the this vijñānaṁ anidassanaṁ, and relating it to that as a he translated it as consciousness without surface. So that, in other words, normal sensory consciousness is experienced because it has a surface against which it lands, the sense organs and their objects, which constitute the all. For instance, one experiences visual consciousness because of the eye and forms of which one is conscious. Consciousness without surface, however, is directly known, without intermediary, free from any dependence on conditions at all. In terms of the above image, it is a paradoxical luminosity that does not reflect off of anything at all. This consciousness thus differs from the consciousness factor in dependent co-arising, which is defined in terms of the six sense media. Lying outside of time and space, it would also not come under the consciousness aggregate, which covers all consciousness near and far, past, present, and future. And as Sutta Saṅyutta 35 notes, the all in the Buddhist teaching covers only the six sense media, which is another reason for not including this consciousness under the aggregates. However, the fact that it is outside of time and space in a dimension where there is no here, there, or in between, no coming or going or staying, means that it cannot be described as permanent or omnipresent, terms that have meaning only within space and time. Some have objected to the equation of this consciousness with Nibbana, on the grounds that Nibbana is nowhere else in the canon described as a form of consciousness. Thus they have proposed that consciousness without surface be regarded as an arahant's consciousness of Nibbana in meditative experience, and not Nibbana itself. This argument, however, contains two flaws. One, the term vijñāna anidassanaṁ also occurs, Digha Nikāya 11, where it is described as where name and form are brought to an end, surely a synonym for Nibbana. And two, if Nibbana is an object of mental consciousness, as a Dhamma, it would come under the all as an object of the intellect. There are passages in the canon that describe meditators experiencing Nibbana as a Dhamma, but these passages seem to indicate that the description applies up through the level of non-returning. Other passages, however, describe Nibbana as the ending of all Dhammas. For instance, blah, 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 quotes the Buddha as calling the attainment of the goal the transcending of all Dhammas. There's a couple verses in the Sutta Nipata state that the arahant has transcended dispassion, said to be the highest Dhamma. Thus, for the arahant, Nibbana is not an object of consciousness. Instead, it is directly known without mediation. Because consciousness without surface is directly known without mediation, there seems good reason to equate the two. So I don't know whether that clarified or confused. But I mean, I thought it was important to read it out, but that there's a whole variety of the Buddha is pointing to something that is definitely beyond normal, the normal sort of functioning of the mind, and pointing to what is a basis of the freedom from all dukkha. So that I think these are aspects of the experiential realm that are helpful to explore, investigate, pay attention to. I wouldn't obsess over it. That in itself is a source of dukkha. But I think it's helpful to realize that the Buddha really is pointing to something transcendent and something beyond what it's not as if because that is kind of a view in kind of contemporary Buddhist circles of basically Nibbana is maybe a shedding of some of the neuroses of of human existence, but you feel good and it's kind of nice, there's something way deeper going on, and that the Buddha has really penetrated the nature of existence and the nature of liberation, freedom. One of the things also in terms of, yesterday Ajahn Kunrunama and I were kind of talking about it after the reading yesterday, that the nature of somebody who has liberated mind, liberated consciousness, it's not as if they don't experience what is pleasant or unpleasant, or experience something which is likable or unlikable, and isn't able to make judgments on that, Ajahn Liam uses it a lot when he teaches. Itta lamana anitta lamana, so that objects of mind that are likable or unlikable, and that's, how do you say, that's prior to the kind of, it's with the presence of feeling, but it's prior to the formulating of a reaction, so that one's and the investment that one, so that's an there isn't attachment or desire within that experience, but of course if one invests in that with ignorance and desire, then it's going to take one down the course of experiencing suffering, complication, entanglement. And there's examples of that there's a discourse. Is it Sutta Nipata? I can't remember. Maybe it's in some Sanyutta Nikaya. Bani Alavaka? Sutta Nipata. Where Alavaka, the yaka, comes up to the Buddha sitting quietly and keeping to himself. And Alavaka, the yaka, comes up and kind of sits up really close to him, and the Buddha pulls away, and Alavaka sort of what kind of someone are you? You're kind of reacting to your likes and dislikes, and you obviously have aversion towards me. And the Buddha is sort of saying, I don't have aversion, but your touch is unpleasant. that's an ordinary aspect of contact, and one doesn't need to mire oneself in what is unpleasant or just follow along on what is blindly on what is pleasant. but one makes choices around that with wisdom and discernment and mindfulness. Similarly, I think of in the Vinaya, one of the reasons for having tooth woods, like the Buddha encourages us using tooth woods for brushing one's teeth, and one of the reasons for, and he gave five different reasons, one of the reasons is because it makes the food taste better. Having a clean mouth and looking after you, not letting your teeth rot on you, it makes your food taste better. So that, that's not an impediment to one's enlightenment, that one should not experience something that actually tastes pleasant. So that, but of course, there's other places where the Buddha sort of says, beware of taste. So that's a natural part of the process of the mind. One just recognizes that, but then one's making those kind of clear discernments, and because one's not responding to it with ignorance and desire, then the consciousness doesn't land and grow. There isn't a basis for it to turn into the process of becoming a sense of an I, me, and mine. And of course, the fundamental objects of that tend to be the feeling, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness itself. Any questions?
Just a clarification. So, say in the experience of an unpleasant kind of contact or unpleasant experience, that experience can be just experienced at the level of feeling and perception, but then it doesn't have to go into the reactive state where
right. It
generate a volitional formation.
Right. Right, and that's the sense of just recognizing what its fundamental nature, and then not buying into the reaction of aversion or desire. And in the same chapter, there's a good illustration of this with Lumbudun, one of the disciples, senior disciples of Ajahn Mun. And Lumbudun lived at his monastery in Surin for 50 years without spending a rains retreat elsewhere. It used to be on the edge of town. And it's in the middle of town, and because of that, it's quite noisy. Especially during occasions like the Elephant Festival or New Year, it can be a week or two of constant impingement. For any of the monks and novices who are not firm in their practice, it'd be quite disrupting. Whenever anyone would complain, Lumpu would instruct, "Why are you bothering to take interest in such things? It's ordinary for light to be bright. It's ordinary for sound to make noise. That's its duty. If we don't take an interest in it, it stops right there. Look after yourself so that you're not an enemy to the circumstances you're in, because the circumstances are just that way. That's all. Just see things with true wisdom, and that's enough." And Lumbudun was very special. The opportunity to meet him on several occasions. A very beautiful monk.
In those two sutras we read, in that sequence, that ends in not being advocated, who pains. I noticed that it starts out with with impersonal descriptions.
Yes.
And then at one point, partway through, a personal pronoun comes in. And I don't know if that's in the Pali or whether you refer to the significance of that.
Hmm. Yes. Yeah, it becomes he. By being liberated is it? Yeah, when that consciousness is unestablished, not coming to growth, non-generative, it is liberated. By being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, he is not agitated. So that, I mean, it's recognizing it's not just floating off somewhere. It is an actual person. And of course, this whole thing of being a person then turned into a whole sort of Buddhist philosophy that whole different schools, raging controversies for centuries of the nature of the pugala. But the Buddha is just sort of, to me, my humble opinion, saying what the Buddha is doing, which is, I don't know how safe that is. It's just a recognition of the conventional nature of that experience. It's not just floating around. The Buddha sort of saying, yeah, because if this doesn't become personal in that sense, then it becomes abstract, and then one ceases to have the kind of motivation to really sort of recognize, oh yeah, I can do this. I can become not agitated. This being here can actually be, I can do that. That's my take on it.